All right, let's go ahead and open it. We're in John 2. This will be our, I think, our last week in John 2. I will just start tonight by looking one more thing in this Israel's prophetic calendar kind of concept. Remember, in John 2, you should be very familiar with these points. I've had them up the last 3 weeks, but I just wanted to throw them up and refresh our memory. The main takeaway from John 2, it's an extremely important chapter because on the one hand, the first thing we learn is we have the extremes of the hearts in Israel. We have Mary on the one side as kind of the representative of that believing remnant of Israel. We know a lot about what's in Mary's heart. Luke 1, 2, and 3 tell us a lot about what's in Mary's heart. And so what's in Mary's heart is what's in generally the hearts of that believing remnant. So that's one extreme. Now we're at the cleansing of the temple, and Jesus encounters the religious leaders there. And now we have the other extreme in Israel. And we know a lot about the religious leaders' hearts, too, because we studied Matthew already. And we know what's in their hearts. And there's not a lot of good things he could say about what's in their hearts. So that's kind of the other extreme of the hearts in Israel and during Christ's earthly ministry. And the reason that's important is because now, as we meet every other character as we go through the book of John, next is Nicodemus, the Samaritan woman, and on through all those other characters, they're all going to fall somewhere in that spectrum between Mary and the vain religious system. And that adds a little bit of interest and excitement to the, I guess you'd call it, the plot of the book of John. The second thing that we learn from the book of John, the second thing John is trying to do with this second chapter, is he's turning our eyes to God's program with Israel. In his encounter with Mary, remember he says, "My hour has not yet come." He draws our attention not to Paul, not to anything going on in the dispensation of grace, his mystery program that was never spoken of before. He's drawing our attention to the hour, to the appointed time that's revealed in Daniel's time schedule, the Israel's prophetic clock. And then in the last half of chapter 2, here with the temple and the religious leaders, it begins and ends with a statement about the Passover. And so there, the first half, he draws our attention to Israel's prophetic clock. The second half, he's going to draw our attention to Israel's prophetic calendar. And we looked at that. We're not even going to talk about this. We're here at the Passover. This is where the Passover is. We just looked at these basic breakdown of these feasts, these seven feasts. They're kind of easy to remember because you got two groups of three, one in the spring and one in the fall, and Pentecost falls in between. So right now, he's gone. Look at John 2, verse 13. "And the Jews' Passover was at hand." And then he cleanses the temple. He goes into the temple, cleanses, interacts with the Jewish leaders, says some things about his upcoming death and resurrection. And then look how it closes down in verse 23. "Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover." So he goes before the Passover, cleanses the temple, and then not long after that, it's the Passover has come. So we're picking up on this, and today we've spent last week looking at the Passover. Today we're going to look at unleavened bread and the kind of first fruits concept. And then we'll probably leave the rest of these as we come up to them in the book of John. We'll get some more details on them. All right, so God gave Israel prophetic calendar, and that's what we're going to focus on today. That's drawn our attention through the Passover, which is the first of the year. At the beginning of the year, it's the first of the feasts in those cycles. God gives them this annual set of feast days, an annual prophetic calendar, whereby believing Israel could participate in a prophetic preview that showed how the Lord was going to provide Israel Israel with her national salvation. Remember, we've talked about this in the past. When you're in the non-Pauline scriptures, what's manifested, what's fully revealed, what's fully explained is Israel's national salvation. If you want to know how, have a full explanation, a full manifestation, all the nuts and bolts of how God saves individuals, going all the way back to Adam's fall, how he saves individuals through Adam, born into this world as ungodly sinners on enemy status before him, that's explained by Paul. You got to go to Paul for the full explanation of that. And so we have to keep that in mind. This prophetic calendar, the Passover here, is not the way God saves individual sinners. It's the way God saves his friends and makes them participants in Israel's national salvation. And we've been over that past, so I just bring him back to that, back to memory. This part, the part, their part, the believing remnants part in this opportunity is to carry out a simple little memorial vignette of clearing out the leaven of their household. And that's what I want to do tonight. I want to look at that. To me, this is going to be, to me anyway, hopefully it is for you too, is going to be a fun little message, maybe a stretch our thinking a little. And I'm hoping it's just a fun message, thinking along these lines. But let's go to Exodus 12:15. You can keep a bookmark in John. I guess I'll do that in case I go back there. So let's go to Exodus 12. That's where we learn about the Passover instructions. Exodus 12, and look at verse 15. Well, I guess let's look at verse 14, because this brings up this whole memorial kind of concept with the Passover. This is Exodus 12, verse 14. "And this day shall be unto you for a memorial, and ye shall keep it a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it a feast by the ordinance forever," which is kind of ironic. This was written before their history started. We're at the Exodus here. But we looked last week and saw they didn't keep the Passover very much. And we looked at that last week. There were a lot of big gaps in their keeping of the Passover. And then after their return to the land from the Babylonian captivity, they began to observe it annually, but it was taken over by the vain religious system and just became another one of those external, vain, ceremonial things that were done without faith. Unacceptable to God. And that's what's going on in the days of Jesus. And Jesus is in here now, and he's cleansing the temple. Well, let's read why he may be cleansing the temple. Look at verse 15. "7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. Even the first day you shall put away leaven out of your houses. For whosoever eateth leavened bread from the first day until the seventh, the soul shall be cut off from Israel." So that's what I want to look at today. I want to look at this leaven concept, and we'll just kind of introduce this and go from there. So let's go ahead and look at this leaven. When using, you understand leaven when it's used as a metaphor, which is the way we usually use it. We're usually not literally talking about its literal thing. We're usually referring to it as a metaphor. But to really understand the metaphor, you have to first establish the literal sense, the literal meaning. And I kind of going to go off on a little way here. If you follow along, and if you don't like it when it's done, go ahead and throw it away. This isn't anything I'm going to fight over. I just found this to be a fun, I think I even called this a kind of thought exercise, a thought experiment with the word leaven, and what leaven, more importantly, what leaven does. And looking at it a little way that isn't, it's not typically looked at. Maybe my problem is I make a lot of bread. I love making bread. I'm an expert at making bread. And I have my own leaven. And I love that leaven. And I have even named that leaven. And I've had that leaven for a decade. So maybe I have a special heart place in my heart for leaven and want to work on it a little bit here. But whatever the reason is, stick with me on this and see if it doesn't open up the scriptures a little. That's all I'll say. When we use the word leaven, when it comes to the use of the word leaven in the Bible, we usually ignore its literal meaning. Usually that doesn't even come into play, and we just jump right to the metaphorical meaning. And usually it's an automatic response, leaven equals sin. It's treated almost as though they're synonyms. They mean the same thing. If it says leaven, you can just insert sin. And I guess if it says sin, you can just insert leaven. They're equal things. They're basically synonyms. So let's see. Let's take a look at the word leaven again. That's the automatic way it's looked at. I had a college professor tell me once, because I was looking for an idea for a paper, a topic for a paper, and he said, the best way to find a topic for a paper is find something everybody agrees on. Everyone thinks they've got it figured out, kind of like a universal law that everybody thinks is the way it is. And he says, usually when it comes to that point, nobody even discusses it anymore because everyone thinks they know what it means. Those are the greatest topics to go look at and reevaluate them. So I'm going to come here. I'm going to follow that guidance. If I remember correctly, in that class, it did very well for me on my term paper. And we're going to look at the word leaven. Go a little bit further, a little beyond just the automatic knee-jerk response, leaven equals sin, and kind of take a look at that. So that's what we got ahead from us. And see if that doesn't open the scriptures a little bit. If we look at the English dictionary, I looked, checked three. I think it was Merriam-Webster, Oxford, and Collins dictionary, and they basically all agreed that leaven in the English is a substance that is used in dough to make it rise. So there's your literal primary meaning for the word leaven. Then from that, kind of follows from that, a pervasive influence that modifies something or transform it for the better. No one adds leaven to make something worse. You add leaven to make something better. You add leaven to a mixture of flour and water and salt. If you just baked flour and water and salt, that lump, you threw it in the oven and baked it, you know what you'd be able to do with that? Absolutely nothing. Well, the only thing you could probably do with it is use it as a doorstop. That little bit of leaven in there is what makes a bread dough bread. It's what makes it in there. It's a pervasive influence that permeates something, that's added in a little amount, and that modifies it. And the general, common, everyday, literal sense is it's for the better. It's to improve something. And of course, all you got to do is look at bread. Look at bread. And we use the word leavened all the time, don't we? He leavened his dry speech with humor. There we use the word leaven. The word levity, kind of lightness, happiness, that comes from the word leaven. Those all come from that English background of that word. Perhaps more importantly is the Hebrew background to that word. The Hebrew background comes from a word that I was surprised to learn this. It comes from a word that means what remains or is left over, a remnant. A remnant? Does that sound like anything we talk about all the time? Noah's family, for instance, in Genesis 7:23, was called a remnant of humanity that survived after that flood. Noah's family was going to be that little remnant that was going to produce all of humanity, the whole of humanity. Of course, we're always talking about the believing remnant of Israel, that remnant concept, and we won't turn to these passages. We've talked about it enough, but I've gave you a whole bunch there if you want to look those up afterwards. or on your own Bible time. So the basic bottom line with leaven in the Hebrew is it carries over into that English idea, something very small that is so powerful it affects something big, the whole thing, causing it to rise. The most common literal example of this, of course, is bread, leftover. And there it's used, the leftover dough, the remnant dough, the leaven of the dough is pulled out. You know, you'd make a loaf of bread, it'd be leavened. And before you bake that loaf, that dough ball, you would pull out a chunk of that older dough you're ready to bake, put it aside in a little container, put the bread that's the dough that's leavened in the fridge, it's going to make a nice loaf of bread. And then tomorrow when you're ready to make bread again, you take that little bit of remnant leaven and you put it in the new water, flour, salt mixture. And you mix it up and you save a little bit of that then for the next day and you bake what you made, and it just goes on and on like that down through the line. And it causes a small bit of leftover dough put into a large mound of new dough, causes it to rise to be a big loaf. And it's to improve. If you didn't have any leavener, well, if you can make a flatbread without leaven, but it's usually pretty thin. It certainly wouldn't be a loaf, wouldn't be bread. It might be a flatbread, but not what we would call loaf bread. So this then was the extended to the primary metaphor for leaven. Something that when added to something else, even in extremely small amounts, gradually but powerfully affects the whole thing. And that's something I just want you to keep in mind, as that's how this works. That's how it's going to work. We haven't talked about anything, whether it's good or bad. Now, as a matter of fact, its literal background is almost always good. It's to make something better than it was before. And so at this point, leaven can be either a power for the good or a power for the evil. It depends, always depends, like every other word in English or Hebrew. It depends on the context. It's just a word, leaven. It can be something good. It can be something bad. And generally in common usage, outside the Bible at least, it's generally something for the good. And so we need to base it on context of, and on the everyday level is generally good. It was very good that you can make a big loaf of bread out of a little leftover dough, as using a little leftover dough as leaven. All right, so now let's get back to the Bible. That's kind of the background. That's the literal usage of the word leaven. And with that little bit of background, now we're going to look at what Bible teachers say, what the Bible says about it. And so contrary to everyday use, kind of opposite of what everyday use, most Bible commentators suggest that leaven is always meant to be something negative, something bad. Leaven equals sin. You see the word leaven, you put in the word sin. They go, they're basically synonyms. And sometimes they'll try to justify that by explaining that leaven, it causes fermentation, and therefore it corrupts. But does that really hold water? Are there other things used and offered to God, even fire offerings to God, which means God actually partakes in them, that are fermented? There is, and we'll take a look at that as we go down here. So this can't be correct. Innumerable treasured and invaluable foods are fermented, not the least of which is wine. Wine is probably one of the most fermented substances of all. I mean, bread might ferment for a day or two, but wine ferments for weeks and months and years. It's highly fermented, but it's required in offerings, even offerings that go on the fire. And the idea with the fire offerings is they're actually participated in by God because they goes up in the flames. and it's participated in by God. And here you have wine is way more highly fermented than leavened bread. And so under controlled conditions, leaven always results in something good and always makes it better. And I don't think there's a correlation there. Fermented foods don't automatically mean corrupted things that can't be come into God's presence. Wine is an example, something far more highly fermented that is required in some direct offerings, in some of the offerings. Fermented foods as a whole, without fermented foods, it is doubtful nations in the Middle East or anywhere else would have survived. Because of the fluctuations of weathers and seasons and enemies, their food source was always in doubt. Shortages of water, fermented foods, which kept longer, they have a much longer shelf life. They had all kinds of fermented foods in the Middle East. Fermented milk, they had cheeses, they had grains that were fermented, and they used those because of their hot environment for storage application. They could store the foods longer. If wine could be used in sacrifices of fire, again, which indicate there are things, not just something put around or on the altar, but actually go up in fire, which means they go up to God, then if the leaven isn't accepted, it's not because of the fermentation, because other foods that are fermented are offered to God. So there has to be something else than fermentation equals corruption or leaven equals sin. So we're back to this. Context determines whether the meaning is negative or positive. So we could go back and forth here. We can go, yes, this is the one most people bring out. Yes, Israel was commanded not to add leaven for some sacrifices and feasts. And of course, the feast we're talking about now, Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, they commanded not to put in leaven. And there's some grain, like the grain offering, no leaven is allowed. But what is not often correlated with that, there's other offerings and other feasts that God commands leaven to be put in. And that was the peace offering and the Feast of Pentecost. So you're kind of, it kind of goes back and forth a little. Yes, when we get to the gospel accounts, Jesus refers to the leaven of the Pharisees. A little bit of their teachings, have corrupted the whole nation. But in that same gospel, he also refers to the kingdom of God as being like leaven, a growth that results in something good. So there's a little bit of back and forth here. So just keep that in mind. I'm not going to argue this point. As a matter of most commentators automatically equate leaven and sin as though they were literally the same thing, rather than just metaphorically, they're similar in certain instances or certain characteristics. I guess that would be a metaphor. Doesn't have to be so similar, isn't exactly the same as something else in every point in detail. A metaphor is just something that has at least one characteristic like what its literal counterpart is. It doesn't mean it has to be like that thing in every detail. It just has to be metaphorically similar in some one or more details. But I'm not going to argue that point. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to go a little bit sidestep from that. What I'm going to do now is pick it up from here. And even if we concede, just for the sake of argument, I'm just going to set that whole argument aside. If you want to think leaven always means something negative and sin, that's fine. I'm going to set that whole thing aside. I'm going to concede that every time in the Bible it's used negatively. I'll go ahead and concede that for argument's sake. I don't really think that, but let's concede it for argument's sake and look at something else that I want to bring out about this leaven concept. So we can concede that if we concede it and think that every time the Bible uses the word leaven, it's always with negative connotations. We have to also concede that even if that's true, it is also true that God, when God powerfully works, he does positively what leaven does negatively. And you'll see, if that doesn't quite make sense right off the bat, you'll see as we go through there. This is where the thought experiment comes in. This is where we're going to have to think a little bit, go a little bit below the surface. What I'm going to suggest is that even if we concede every place the Bible uses the specific word leaven, it's always in a negative. We'll just concede that. But what I'm going to suggest is that what leaven does, and when God powerfully works, he does what leaven does, only positively, from a good standpoint. And you'll see why that's kind of important. Let's look not just at where the word leaven is used, but where the idea of leaven, where the principle of leaven exists. And that takes a little more careful reading. And that's what I want to do tonight. Not fight over whether leaven's negative or positive. We'll concede it's negative. But look at something now beyond that. Look at how leaven works. What characterizes the way leaven works? Even if we concede the when leaven itself is always does that always negatively, when God works that way, it's always positively. And you'll see through a few examples, and I'm doing this because I think this opens up the scriptures. You're going to see this many other areas, and I'm going to give some examples now. When we notice something having the characteristics of leaven, even when the specific word isn't used, we see the leaven principle at work in the Bible. And one might say, and yes, this is the pun is intended here. One might say that this little concept, this principle of leaven, permeates the whole scriptures. And yes, pun intended with that. And we'll kind of go through this as we go through. So now you want to know, what in the world am I talking about? Let's go back to Exodus a little further, and let's go to Exodus 1. Exodus 1. Remember, we were in Exodus 12, and it was the whole no leaven for Passover, no leaven for unleavened feasts, those spring festivals. And now, keeping that in mind, 12 chapters earlier, at the beginning of the beginning of the Exodus. And let's just look at a couple of things, and let me just show you what I'm talking about. We're going to just set aside leaven itself, and we're going to look at the principle of leaven. The leaven principle is what I'm going to call it. Let's go back to Exodus 1. Exodus 1, and pick it up at verse 1. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel, and I'm not going to read through that. We'll just finish that phrase, which came into Egypt. So these are the Israelites. This is the Israel that existed at that time, the sons and family of Jacob, and they go from Canaan to Egypt. And look how many there are here. Verse 5, and all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. So there you got 70 souls that come into Egypt, that are brought into Egypt. 70 souls. You know what that, for a nation especially, that's a pretty small amount. In Egypt itself, I looked this up in an encyclopedia. For Egypt itself, I think they said that it was estimated between 3 and 5 million people, Egyptians, in Egypt. Here you have a group of 70 people come and enter into Egypt. All right? So just keep that in mind, and we're going to try and show here is that this leaven principle is all over the place. 70 people come into a massive Egypt, and what do they do? What do these 70 people do? I'll just say, as you start to think through this, what does a little leaven do in a lump of dough? Look at what it said. Look at verse 7. See, 70 people, they enter into Egypt. In verse 7, and the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceedingly and mighty, and the land was filled with them. When you have a bunch of exclamations and you have a bunch of words that just try and bring out almost beyond what words can say, you know they're trying to make a point here. Look how many different ways. You had these 70 people, this little tiny group, enters into Egypt, totally insignificant. No one even notices them. 3 to 5 million Egyptians running around Egypt. And after a few hundred years in Egypt, look at verse 7 again. Let's just read it again with all the emphasis. They were fruitful. They increased abundantly. They multiplied. They waxed exceeding. And they filled the whole land, the whole nation. They filled it. I remember when we go into the Exodus in the wilderness, based on what it says there, there were 2 to 3 million Israelites that went out in the Exodus. So now this 70 group of people have grown and expanded and risen up in the nation. And now there's almost as many Israelites as there are Egyptians. Now there arose a new king, verse 8, over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out a war, they join our enemies and fight against us and so forth. The Pharaoh's upset about this. The Pharaoh's worried. The Pharaoh thinks that Israel has corrupted the nation. Israel has just started out as these 70 people. Now they've filled the nation. They've risen and filled the nation. And now the Pharaoh is worried about it. And he's going to go to pretty big extent to deal with them. Let's go down to verse 16. You know the story in the first chapter here. I'm not going to read through the whole chapter. But look at the king's response in verse 15. And the king of Egypt spoke. First of all, they're going to afflict the Israelites, right? In the verses before that, they give them the impossible tasks and jobs. And then verse 15, and the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the one was Shifra, and the name of the other was Puah. And he said, when ye do the office of the midwife to the Hebrew women to see them upon the stool, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, he shall live. And of course, we know the midwives didn't do that, didn't obey what the Pharaoh said, and were rewarded for that. And all. My only point is to bring out this principle. Here you had a little group of people, a little group come and they entered into Egypt, and not too long afterwards, they've grown, they're mighty, they've permeated every area of Egypt. My point is, leaven is a little bit in the eyes of the beholder. To Egypt, Israel was like leaven. Something that started out small, 70 individuals, but was viewed as affecting the whole nation. They became millions, grieving Pharaoh because it affected the whole nation. And of course, in his view, it was affecting it negatively. And he wanted to purge them out. I thought if we get rid of all their newborn sons, they'd begin to diminish and die out, and he'd purge them out of the house of Egypt. But of course, go fast forward to Exodus 12. And now you have, but that God now is telling the Israelites to purge out the leaven, to purge out Egypt from them. Throw out everything that has to do with Egypt and their religious system and their idolatry and their false gods and all that stuff they've become familiar with in Egypt. They're supposed to clear all that out. And why does he want them to leave the nation of Israel as unleavened dough? Because he's going to raise them up himself. He wants them to rely solely on himself. Get rid of all the leaven of Egypt, get it all out, everything associated with their gods, their idolatry. What does he teach? We've been over this many times too. What does he teach them in the 40, 50 days in the wilderness? he teaches them about the grace resident in his Jehovah name. He's teaching them, I'm the God above all other gods. I'm the one and only God. I'm your God. All you have to do is rely on me. Don't rely on anything from Egypt. Rely on me. And he takes them through the wilderness there. So to God, Egypt was a leaven, which needed to be removed from Israel so that they could trust him completely, trust completely in him. And he tells them in Exodus 12, purge out all the leaven. Everything associated with dependence on Egypt and her things, now go out with me and learn to rely on me as I take you through the wilderness. God's going to deliver Israel from Egypt. He doesn't want them to take any of their little bits of gods and idolatry lest they affect the whole nation. He wants them to get rid of even the tiniest bits of the tiniest remnants, the tiniest bits of leaven from the nation of Egypt so that when he takes them out, they can be in complete reliance upon him as he teaches them to rely upon him. And so he's going to do that. And I'm just trying to point out, once you go beyond the word leaven and look at the leaven principle, you see it all over the place. Here you have this irony, just as Pharaoh grieved over Israel, Israel's affecting the whole nation of Egypt, so too God out in the wilderness is going to grieve when Israel brings Egypt and its idolatry into their relationship with him. Remember, they get out in the wilderness. As soon as they run on some hard times, what do? They murmur, they complain, and what do they say? We want to go back to Egypt. We did better there than we're doing out here. And they were supposed to get rid of all that. They're supposed to keep reenacting every year removal of everything that provides a reliance, except for reliance on the Lord God of Israel. And so just as Pharaoh grieved over Israel's affecting his nation, so too God will grieve over Israel when she brings Egypt's things into their relationship with God. And there we see them doing exactly that. And we see doing just that when they go out into the wilderness with him. And I'm just trying to bring out, doesn't that open the scriptures a little? Here you have at the beginning of the book, there's an irony here. Here you have Pharaoh. He's looking at the Israelites as, I guess you could say, leaven. They're ruining his nation. They're come in and they could take over the nation. They've started out as 70 people, and they've multiplied and permeated and risen up and gone in throughout the whole nation. He wants to get rid of Israel. Of course, when God gives him the chance to do that by him taking them out, he doesn't want to do it that way. He comes up with these other schemes, but that's another lesson. And then the Lord is, now you get to chapter 12, the Pharaoh wanted to remove Israel. God's Israel wants to remove Egypt and Pharaoh. And so you have this little irony going on in the book of Exodus. So God gave them the Passover and unleavened bread when Pharaoh's Egypt wanted to do with the Lord's Israel. What Pharaoh's Egypt wanted to do with the Lord's Israel, they wanted to purge them out, destroy them. The Lord's Israel was supposed to do with Pharaoh's Egypt. Take out the leaven at the first Exodus and rely solely on the Lord. It is something that they will all do. There's going to be another Exodus. We've talked about this before, too, at the end time Exodus, at Christ's second coming. There's going to be another Exodus in this. It's a far greater Exodus. And at that time, they're going to be in Exodus. And when they come out of the Exodus, what happens to the Egyptian empire? It crashes. Well, that end time Exodus, when they are called out of the nations, called out of the apostate nation of Israel, called out all those Gentile nations at Christ's second coming, and he calls them out, they've been reduced as far as Satan can reduce them. They've been diminished. They've been attacked. They've been persecuted. They think they've made the believing remnant insignificant and unimportant. God's going to call them out. And guess what it's going to do at the second coming? It's going to cause Satan's whole world system to collapse. And you got a little picture here of the big picture that's going to go on at that time. It's going to bring up at the end of time. Removal by death of the small remnant of Israel deflated will cause the whole nation to fall. Look how this works. Go to Exodus 9 now. Exodus 9. Exodus 9, verse 16. He's explaining here what his purpose is. Exodus 9, verse 16. "And in very deed for this cause have I raised thee up." He's talking to Pharaoh here. "For to show in thee my power, and that my name may be declared throughout all the earth." And so there you have, I guess read verse 17, "As yet exalteth thyself against my people, thou wilt not let them go." You'd think Pharaoh would want to let them go. He was worried about them at the beginning, but now that God is commanding and asking of him, he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to do it God's way. He wants to do his own way, and of course it's going to end disaster for him. But the goal of this all was that the nations would recognize who God is. This Israel has the one true God. And God's going to put it on display at the first Exodus, here in Exodus, and it's going to be an infinitely greater display of that at the second great Exodus at Christ's return. That's what's going to be going on here, and he's going to do this now in this 11 concept comes up over and over again. The Lord required Israel to remove all leaven of Egypt, all reliance on Egypt and its idolatry and all its ways, so that they could be a new unleavened dough. You know what they take out with them? They take out their unleavened dough and their kneading troughs. They don't take out the bread. Now, they might have had some flatbreads and stuff like that available. They take out the dough. I think that's an important thing, because what that represents is what God's going to do. God takes them out of Egypt as not unleavened bread, but as unleavened dough, so that he can put his own teaching, his own things into them. And we'll see that as we go through the history here. He's going to inflate them. He's going to rise them up himself. He doesn't want them raised up with Egypt's things. He wants them leaving as unleavened dough without any of Egypt's leaven in there. And he's going to take them out in the wilderness, and he's going to raise them up with his things. Now let's watch as we go through here. At the end of the journey, we're going to see this is exactly what happens. He takes them out as unleavened bread. They leave as these slaves of Egypt. They go out in the wilderness with the Lord as unleavened dough. He works with them for this 40 or 50 days, just a short amount of time. And look what he's able to accomplish with them. Go to Exodus 19. Exodus 19. So now we're at the end of the journey. It's just been a few weeks. He's taken them out of Egypt, unleavened dough. But look what he's done with them. Remember, what is leaven? Our literal definition of leaven is something inserted to make something rise, something inflate, something to be carried along, permeated and carried along. Now look what the Lord says he did with Israel. Go to Exodus 19. Look how, when he gives a summary of this, he says in Exodus 19:4, he says, "You have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." That "bear" there, That is the idea of bearing along. The literal translation there is rising up. He rose them up in those wilderness wanderings. They were he wanted them to leave Egypt, get rid of all of Egypt's leaven, anything that could affect them from Egypt, go out in the wilderness as unleavened dough. And he put his own things in them that bore them along, that carried them along, that raised them up, lifted them up. And now he's brought them all the way to Sinai through all those things. And you just think of all the things that happened during those last 40, 50 days in that meantime. They took their dough with them. It'll keep your finger here, but go to Exodus 12 and just we can see that how they left Egypt. Exodus 12, verse 34. Exodus 12, keep your finger in chapter 18 and 19. We'll be back there. Exodus 12, verse 34. And the people took their dough with them. Notice it doesn't say they took their breads. If you have unleavened dough, you could make skinny flatbreads. You can't make a loaf, but you can make flatbreads. It doesn't say they took their breads. It says they took their dough. And it's unleavened dough. Then you get to the end of the journey. Well, let's just finish reading. Let me just finish this verse here. Before it was leavened, they're kneading troughs. So why would they need kneading troughs if they have unleavened dough? You don't need to knead anything. The reason you knead is to distribute the leaven. And they were going out with their unleavened dough and their kneading troughs, but they didn't have anything to knead into the dough. Well, that's what God gave them. He taught them about the grace resident in His Jehovah name. He said, get rid of all that stuff you rely on from Egypt, their gods, their idolatries, all that kind of pagan nonsense. Come out as unleavened dough and come in the wilderness with me. Bring your kneading troughs because I'm going to give you things and you're going to need what I teach into that dough. And I'm going to raise you up, bear you along on eagle's wings, lift you up high, inflate you so that you can be the people I designed you to be. Now, did that happen? And so let's go back to Exodus. Oops. Exodus chapter 18 now. Did that happen? Now we know the beginning and end. They left as deflated little bits of unleavened dough. That's how they left. They had their kneading troughs, but they didn't have anything to knead with because you knead it with to get the leaven distributed. If you just stuck leaven in the middle of a lump of dough, you know, it wouldn't do anything. You got to knead the leaven throughout so it's distributed throughout the dough. And they go with their unleavened bread. They go with their kneading trough. And God gives them what to knead into that dough. And what He gives them, the grace resident in His Jehovah name, His teaching, their reliance on Him is what's going to inflate them, raise them up, bear them along as on eagle's wings, rise them above all the other nations of the world, and they will fulfill His plan and purpose to be His light to the Gentiles, the proclaimer of His name to the Gentiles. So that's what he says in Exodus 19:4. Did it work? Well, let's see if it worked. Go back a few verses and go back to chapter 18 and look what this, just a few days before this, they were nothing but a bunch of slaves in Egypt. They got rid of Egypt stuff, went out in the wilderness with the Lord. He gave them His stuff. He says at the end of the line, I bore them along, I raised them up, I carried them along. And look what happened, verse 7, chapter 18, verse 7, Exodus 18, verse 7. Let's begin at verse 8. Exodus 18, verse 8. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians and Israel's for Israel's sake, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. Now, his father-in-law, we probably should have gone back a couple of verses. His father-in-law is a Midianite. You know what a Midianite is? It's a Gentile. He's a ruler of a Gentile nation. And here you got Moses telling him about the one true God of Israel. Now look at his response, verse 9. Jethro, the Midianite, the Gentile Midianite, verse 9, rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel. See, that's Israel's function. That's what she's going to do out there in the end times in the kingdom. The nations are going to look on Israel, see all that God did for Israel, and they're going to come to Israel, come to Jerusalem, come to the Christ sitting on his throne in Jerusalem, and they're going to say, do the same thing to us. Do what you did to Israel to us. And Israel's going to dispense God's blessings to all the nations of the world. And here we are a few days after the Exodus, and they're already doing it. They haven't been brought up, really interacted much with God for 300 or 400 years here, depending on how you count it and all that. But now Jethro's rejoiced. Now a Gentile, verse 9, is rejoicing for all the goodness which the Lord hath delivered Israel from the Egyptians. And Jethro said, blessed be the Lord who hath delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh and out of the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, for in this thing wherein they dealt proudly, he was above them all. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices to God. And Aaron came, and all the elders of Israel, to eat bread with Moses, and so forth. So here you have a bunch of slaves in Egypt. They're told to get pictorially, metaphorically, get rid of all the leaven, all their associations with Egypt, all their connections, all their reliances on Egypt, and their idolatries, and their gods, and their religious system, all that nonsense. Go out in the wilderness with the Lord as unleavened dough. Bring their kneading troughs, and he's going to give them. He's going to knead into them through various trials along the way. He's going to knead into them his things. He's going to knead in them his truth about reliance on the grace resident in his Jehovah name. He's going to knead into them how they need to rely on him if they're going to be the people he designed to be them to be. He kneads into them during those wilderness wanderings all the things they need to see about their one true God. And by the time you get to the end of this journey, he's filled them up, carried them along, raised them up, and they're all ready. Before they ever got the law at Sinai, before that was even in there, they're already fulfilling God's mission for them, proclaiming God's name to the Gentiles. Here you have a Gentile Midianite worshiping God together with Israel and through Israel. Exactly what their ultimate goal is. So I'm just bringing out this concept. Even if the word leaven isn't used, what leaven does negatively, remember we conceded leaven's always negative. Negative, it's Egypt's leaven. God's work isn't called leaven, but his work in him does what leaven does, only positively. It works positively. It raises them up and inflates them. It carries them along. And so I think, to me, that's interesting. I think it opens up these Bible passages. And when you start looking for it, looking not so much for the word leaven, but for what leaven does, and then looking at the context, good or bad, and you see this throughout the scriptures. Just in some other examples from Exodus, a little blood smeared on the door. Just a little bit smudge of blood on the doorpost, on the cross of the door, and it saved the whole nation. At the golden calf incident, remember what happened at the golden calf incident? The whole nation carries out this idolatrous act. God says, get out of the way, Moses. I got to go down and consume them. He's got a lightning bolt in each hand. Boom, boom. done. And what does he say? He says, I'll begin a new nation with you, Moses. One little old Moses, and it's going to result in a whole new nation. I would suggest the leaven principle. Even though the word leaven isn't used there, it's the principle. God can take little things and grow them into something large and increase them to something large. Jesus' death and resurrection. We won't turn there because of time. And I want to get to one last example to close with. Jesus' death and resurrection in John 12:24, he talks about that unless one seed fall into the ground and die, he's alone. But if he goes into that ground, is buried and died, and rises again, he rises again with a multitude of seed. While the word leaven isn't used there, I would suggest the leaven principle is used there. God working not to do something negative, but to do something positive. It's the leaven principle, something small that ends up affecting something very large. As you go through here, you can see these examples. I listed out about 15 more just in the book of Exodus. So I'm going to leave that to you, though. I'm just giving you this principle. I think it opens up. I think it makes it more enjoyable. You begin with Pharaoh complaining about what he views as the leaven of Israel grown to such a big thing in his nation. And then you have God kind of ironically saying, now get rid of he considers Egypt the leaven. Get that rid of that. And then you see he's going to now bear them along, carry them up, inflate them, rise them up, make them into his nation. I don't know. To me, when I look at the whole picture and start to notice these things, it adds a lot to it. But let's look at an example from not Exodus or the gospel accounts. Let's look at the example, and we'll close with this one with Paul here. Go to Romans 5. And let's just look at another instance, I think, where the word leaven isn't used, but I think the leaven principle is used. And it's used in two different ways, one positively and one negatively. So let's go to verse 12. Romans 5, verse 12. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men. And it's going to talk there about one man and one transgression. So you have this one man and one transgression. Now, what is this one man, this little bit, what is he going to be able to do? It says this one man, sin entered the world and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men. For that all sinned. One man, one sin, and that turned into turned into having powerful to permeate and affect the whole fallen human, old human race. One man, one act of iniquity, one act of transgression, and it affected the whole old humanity. I actually have a commentator that has before verse 12, he actually has as his own little note, the leaven of sin. He has that right at the top of this section. So it's the leaven of sin. But you know what you read? Let's read the couple verses later and let's see something else. Look at verse 15. But not as the offense, so also is the free gift. For if through the offense of one, so here you have one man and his, the offense is Adam, but now you're going to read about one man who does one act of righteousness. Of course, that's the Lord Jesus Christ. One many be dead through the one offense, much more the grace of God and the gift by grace, which is by one man, Jesus Christ, has abounded to many. So here you have one man, one act of righteousness that permeates and is powerful enough to affect the whole new humanity. I'd suggest that's that leaven principle, even though the word leaven is here. Why did that commentary head verse 12 with the leaven of sin when you have the same principle at work in the next one, but he doesn't call it the leaven of righteousness because leaven is associated with something negative. But here, so I'm just going to call it the principle of leaven, the leaven principle, something that starts out that as a remnant, a small bit of something that you put in something large, and it's powerful enough to permeate and affect the whole thing. And that's not only true of Adam and his transgression, that principle's also true as what we rely on every minute of every day as a believer. It's true of Christ and his one act of righteousness that imparts righteousness and life to the whole new humanity in Christ. I suggest that's what I'm calling that leaven principle. But it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there. Let's keep reading in Romans. And if you go back and read all the last half of chapter 5, reading all the verses, we're not going to do that for time's sake, but you'll see this is even brought out more. But let's go to the next thing. One man and his one transgression affected the whole old human race. One man, one act of righteousness, the Lord Jesus Christ, and it affected the whole new humanity. But chapter 5 doesn't end there. Let's read a little more. Verse 20. Moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound. So now you have the law. There's one little law. And the law is good, right? The law, Romans 7, what was it, 7, I think verse 8 or somewhere, verse 12. The law is good and holy and just and right off the drawing boards of heaven. A little bit of law entered the nation of Israel. And what does it say? Oh, it caused. What does it say it brought forth? It affected. Moreover, verse 20, the law entered that the offense might abound. So here you had this little law entered, a good law, and it affected the whole nation by making the offense abound. Because when you give a law to a sinner, it shows their sin. See, the law is such that's a religious nonsense that giving the law to a sinner will show him where he's righteous. The law doesn't look at what you do right. The law looks at what you do wrong. It's just like our civil law, our governmental, the laws in our own country. And so a little law created a bunch of iniquity, sin. And then what did those offenses create? Look, keep reading verse 20. But where sin abounded, grace did much more. Grace super abounded. And so here you have, I'd suggest again, even though the word leaven isn't used here, that this is bringing out that leaven principle. A little law affected a huge amount of offenses, brought forth a huge amount of offenses, and those offenses brought forth an even huger amount of grace. So none of these verses use the word leaven, but they do use the characteristics of leaven that form the basis of the metaphor, which becomes so common it became proverbial. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. All right, so I'm just going to leave it there. Hope maybe this gave you, this is nothing fighting over or arguing over. I just think it was, when I began to see this, I thought it was a very helpful tool. I thought it really opened up some passages in the Bible, brought out some subtleties just in that Exodus account that I was trying to show, going from Exodus 1 to 12 and really on to Exodus 19 and really on to Exodus 32. And brought out some of those things and how all that interplays. So I would just conclude, we'll conclude with this little summary. In the Bible, the negative application of the leaven principle to those things that permeate a person or a people, powerfully leading them away from God. Perhaps key words would be iniquity and idolatry. The idea there is iniquity and idolatry inflate, raise up a person or the group to in unbelief to rebel and be led away from God. The positive application of the leaven principle refers to the things of God that permeate a person or a people, powerfully leading them to God. Key words here would be first fruits, as we saw with the seed, Jesus talking about being a seed that goes in the ground, that dies. First fruits, inflating and raising up the person or group in belief in him and his word. Looking at the word and its definition and concept and the principle by which it works, one might say that a little bit of this principle permeates and powerfully affects the whole Bible. So hopefully I conveyed just a little bit of that idea. Maybe it will inspire you to go and read some other passages from that framework. And yes, the pun was intended.